So a question I'm asked a lot right after I perform is, how did you memorize all of that? And I have a few answers that are ready, because I know I'm going to be asked this at almost every concert. And the first one is that I tell people that the brain is an amazing organ. We really don't give it enough credit. And I think the more that we learn, the more capacity we have to learn. It's actually the opposite of, you tend to think, oh, the brain's going to fill up and I'm not going to be able to learn anymore. It's actually the opposite. The more you fill it, the more it starts to expand, seems like it starts to expand. If I learn one song, the second one's easier. If I learn 20 songs, I can learn that many more. It's really amazing, this process. The second answer that I allude to that's important to me and important to this talk is that I don't have any special power. I think a lot of people might assume that I learn these pieces note by note or measure by measure, and I actually learn them through a set of patterns, the same way we learn knowledge or language. And when I'm up here, my musical mind is referring to a map that I've created. So while I might, you know, make mistakes or falter maybe a little bit as I'm learning a piece and learning to perform it in front of people, I have this map that's always going. So I'm not going to just stop and be like, well, I'm lost, see you later. this map is what David Levitin calls the schema. And this was a book mentioned as part of the Summer of Sound series. David Levitin is the author of This Is Your Brain on Music. And he uses this concept in the book called schema. And it's actually a concept from the Swiss psychologist Jean Piaget. And it's just a concept used to understand how we build knowledge as humans. It's basically the mental templates that our brain creates when we learn. It's also how we learn language, right? I'm not thinking of every single word I'm going to say. I'm referring to templates in a certain situation. And my brain can also fill in information as we go. It's how we understand, musically, how we understand a musical style, how we know it's doom metal, for example, or the blues. We have had enough exposure to different musical styles that our brain has created templates, and we can say, oh, that's the blues. The same way we can understand the sound of a guitar. We've heard many different timbres of instruments, and our brain has created a category for it. We can also identify human voices through this idea of schema. I know it's my friend's voice in a crowded restaurant because my brain has created a certain template or a map. I don't have to analyze every sound in the room and organize it. It would be so much work for our brains. So it's kind of this idea of the shorthand. And we all have this. And why is this important? It's important for this discussion, this talk, because our society is obsessed with musical genius, this idea of prodigy. And in the pre-talk, we talked about talent, this idea of being talented, like having talent or not. And I think that we forget that musical skill is created just like all these other skills that we have, of language, of knowledge, of hearing our friend's voice in a room. And I want to argue that what we often call as genius aren't actually gifts that people were born innately with. They were things that were developed. I also want to argue that we all have musical skill, and I truly believe everybody can learn to sing. But that's another talk. That's another talk. I think environment is a very important factor, too, to this idea of schema. Actually, a schema is impossible without environment. It's all relational. Everything is. And I want to give two examples. I want to start with Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, a name everyone has heard of, the 18th century composer and pianist. And Mozart had a father, Leopold. So Wolfgang and Leopold. Leopold was the dad. He was a renowned pedagogue, composer, pianist, and he taught Mozart from a very young age, and Mozart's older sister. So here's little Mozart with an older sister and a famous dad. And his father basically took Leopold and his sister Nannerl, who almost is not in the history books at all, but was by all right probably a prolific, she was a composer, but a virtuoso pianist that we don't know about. So Mozart and his sister, he took them on tour when Mozart was six. And they basically toured for a period of 4 years in Europe as a duet, playing in dozens of cities throughout Europe. Can you imagine, like, 18th century staying with your sister and your dad in, like, these little boarding room houses and just touring Europe for 4 years? It's insane, the thought. So by the time Mozart was 10, his schema of music was incredibly sophisticated, not only just from a technical level, but from being exposed to all the music throughout Europe. My second example, Yo-Yo Ma, famous cellist. His father was also very similar to Leopold Mozart, Wolfgang's dad. He was a pianist, composer, and a teacher. And he taught Yo-Yo Ma from a young age, the cello. And by the time Yo-Yo Ma was seven, he was playing for President Eisenhower. By the time he was eight, he was playing with his older sister. It's a very similar family setup. He's playing with his older sister for young children's music concerts with Bernstein introducing. So it this idea of environment, really important to developing people that we see as, you know, these musical geniuses. My story, I come from, you know, a middle-class family. I did start piano at a young age and played flute in the band by sixth grade, but I don't consider that anything that much different than a lot of folks who start learning an instrument. I took to music and I kept doing it. I kept building my musical schema, so to speak, and I've just been building on it. 30 years later, as a classical flutist, playing from memory, not many flutists play from memory, they usually use music. Playing from memory has been a real breakthrough for me because it really allows me a connection to my audience, but more importantly, it allows me to build humility, because when you play from memory, you make mistakes and you have to learn by recovering. And I think that this has brought me a real power as a musician, the humility piece. There's a joke that I like to tell. What's the difference between a professional and an amateur musician? The professional, you don't hear the mistakes. It's totally true. and I think that this idea of not claiming to be perfect, not claiming to be a genius, is what Mozart and Yo-Yo Ma learned intuitively as children. And I think that's why it's a great time to learn music as a child, because you're not obsessed with perfection or even of talent or anything like that. They understood that performance is actually kind of a plan B activity, that you're going with the flow and you're making something out of every moment. So as I keep practicing all these years, I've learned that practicing isn't about perfection, and it's also apparent that the more skill I have, the more humility I need up here to accept my mistakes. And I think the mistakes are gifts. They're gifts of learning and awareness, and also of ultimately of empathy. And Andrew's going to continue.
Okay, I'll share a little bit with you about my life and my story. When I went to college, if you had asked me, are you going to be a teacher? I would have said, no, I can't explain anything to anyone else. I just do my thing, man. And at some point in 2002, I kind of just became a teacher. Someone called me and they said, oh, we need a new guitar teacher for this arts outreach program at Grand Rapids Community College. Would you do that? it pays this much, and I was like, okay, I'll be a teacher now. So I started teaching, and I realized that I was in this environment where there was a really developed program for Suzuki violin at this school. And they asked me, do you know there's Suzuki guitar? Would you like to be a Suzuki guitar teacher? And we'll send you to do training in California, and we'll pay for the whole thing. And I was like, I want to do that. So I learned some about this method known as the Suzuki method. So Shinichi Suzuki was a violinist and a teacher from Japan who developed this method of teaching that he called the whole thing a talent education. And what he meant by that was that talent is something that can be learned through practice, imitation, and environment. And his way of teaching, he also called the mother language method. And what he thought was that when we learn to speak, when we learn language, we're not given like a book and say, read this now. We learn from listening to others and imitating what other people do. And he thought music should be learned this same way. We shouldn't just start by reading notes. We should start by making a beautiful sound. And he developed this method for teaching young children where you imitate your teacher, you listen, and you learn from your parent and the teacher. And actually, the Walkman, the cassette Walkman, was developed with Sony and Dr. Suzuki for the little kids in Japan who would walk around with this cassette tape that had all the songs that they were going to learn. They'd listen to it all day long while they played outside. And then they'd go to play the violin, and hey, look, they knew how to play the songs. And it's a really, actually, powerful thing. And this is something that I started teaching. I met lots of young children, and really lots of parents. The whole method, they call the triangle method. You have the teacher, you have the student, and you have the parent, and you all work together to make things happen. And it's like the parent needs to create the environment at home of love and of repetition that then the student, the child, can grow into. And that's just as important. I found maybe, actually, I was really teaching the parents. But they thought I was teaching their kid, and whatever, it all kind of worked out. One other important thing about the Suzuki method is that your sound of your instrument or your tone, he would say, is your living soul. And that the way that if you listen to yourself and you will play your instrument in a unique way that no one else will sound like at all. And I've taught also a lot of guitar classes at the college level, beginning guitar, anyone can join. And I'll prove this point by, they think, oh, I have a nice guitar, so I sound better, right? Or whatever. And we could take my guitar and we could pass it around the room. Everyone could play one note and every single person sounds different. And that's a unique, beautiful thing about music. Now, I've also, you know, this method, Suzuki method, is a lot about children, starting when they're 4 or 3. But I've also taught a lot of adults in life, and I've used a lot of these similar concepts working with adults, the idea of listening, the idea of repetition, and the idea of building practice, and the practice of practice, which is that something needs to be done every single day. And so I started practicing music when I was 4. It was something I had to do. My mother put the egg timer on the top of the keyboard and set it to 30, and I had to practice. And I could do that when I came home from school or later, and I wanted to do it right when I got home so that I could go play in the woods, you know. And at some point, after a while, like I just like started doing it. It's like it just automatically happened. And this is something that takes time to learn, but as I've grown into it in my life, it's like the special time in my day where I feel like, oh, I can just do this guitar thing. It's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's like nobody's going to bother me. I can just do this thing and I can feel like really good about myself, and I almost feel like I'm like recharging. And so I've been talking to other people about this and how we can build this practice through repetition. And I got thinking about it, and I thought, like, you know, this idea of relaxation related to repetition. This has got to be a thing. So I did this little search on the internet, and I found these studies of Dr. Herbert Benson, who was a Harvard teacher and medical professor, and he developed this concept that he called the relaxation response. And he went around and taught people about this around 2010. And his idea is that the relaxation response is something that your body can experience where your organs relax, your breath slows down, your body relaxes. And it's an antidote to what is known as the fight or flight response. This is a concept that was developed in the 1920s that, like, your body knows when, like, there's this really intense thing is going to happen, and the adrenaline kicks in, and you like, enter this almost super state of being to, you know, stay alive. And the problem is that in our modern society, our bodies keep thinking that we have to have this fight or flight response, like, every day. Like, many times a day, like, oh my gosh, I gotta get the groceries, and I forgot my thing at home, and then, oh, the spaghetti, and then whatever, you know, this happens to us all day long, and we're basically in this state of intensity, and we can't let go of it. This study that Harvard did in 2010, they found that 75% of adults in America responded that they felt they were at levels of stress that were hurting them physically. And so what Dr. Herbert Benson did is he would go around and teach people how to enter the state of the relaxation response, so that you can recover from this stress that we're experiencing. The way he taught it was through meditation. And a particular form of meditation, a typical, you know, sit, be relaxed, be in a quiet place, close your eyes, listen to your breath. But on top of that, what you need to do is repeat a single word over and over and over and over in your mind. And that after you do that so many times, then you can enter this relaxation state. He also noted that there's other activities that are repetitive that you can enter this relaxation response state, like swimming or running or knitting or playing a musical instrument. And I was like, yeah, that's what I've been talking about. Oh my gosh, like, this is what I've been talking about, that, like, through practicing, like, yeah, you're getting better. Like the quote that's in the bulletin, and Pablo Casals, the famous cellist, you know, who would practice 5 to 6 hours into, like, his 80s. And he would ask him, well, why are you doing that? You're the best cellist ever. And he's like, well, you know, to make progress, to get better. You know, Andre Segovia, the famous Spanish guitarist, would practice famously 4 hours a day until right at the end of his life. And again, they asked him, why are you doing that, maestro? You're the best guitarist ever. And he was like, yeah, to get better. And so I'm thinking, like, not only would we practice an instrument to get better or make progress, but we could also, like improve our health and our quality of being in our modern world. And I think that's a really powerful thing. So not only do I play guitar, but I also write music. The first two pieces we played are compositions that I composed, and people ask me a lot of times, like, how do you do that? What do you think about, you know? And I'll stand by my initial response, and then I'll explain more, which is that, yeah, I just, like, sit and stare at the wall until it makes sound, and then I write it down. Which is kind of true, kind of true. But my first composition teacher, his name was Bob Scheckman, a wonderful, amazing artist. And what he would tell me, and I don't know if everybody's met Bob, he's a pretty amazing, interesting person, but he would say, okay, music's always there. It's always there, man. And what you gotta be like is like a radio, and you gotta put your antenna up and you gotta tune into it. And then you just tap into it, and it, like, comes out of you. And so Carmen and I started going to rustic cabins to write music. This started in 2007. We were artists in residence at Isle Royale National Park, and they brought us out to this cabin, and, you know, it's this beautiful place. And I thought of this idea that my teacher Bob taught me, and it's like I'm being an antenna. And so, like, where I'm at is going to, like, matter in some way with what I write. And so we've been doing this for years, like chasing the ghost, you know, to find the perfect place. And in the summer of 22, 4 years ago, we scheduled like a progressive composing cabin retreat where we rented three different cabins in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Maybe like about right now, the weather was like absolutely perfect. And what I like to do the best is to sit outside at the picnic table. I have my music paper I write by hand and my guitar, and I set out to write a solo guitar piece. I didn't have really any other ideas than that I wanted a solo guitar piece, and it should be a long one. And I sat out all week at the picnic table in these different places, and I wrote this whole piece. And generally, composition involves lots of revision. Like, I'll have, like, whatever, my files on my computer go up to like the 40s, you know, like I've changed it 40 times. And this particular piece came out like 98% done. And I finished it, and I was sitting there. We were at this place called Wells State Park, which is in the UP of Michigan on the border of Wisconsin, looking out at Green Bay. And I was like, uh-oh, what do I call this? You know, we write instrumental music. There's not words to this. I could talk about the structure, blah, 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 but, like, nobody cares about that. That's, you know, I got to, like, have an idea. And I realized I've been looking at Lake Michigan the whole week. I should call this piece Lake Michigan. And that's where I grew up, and I can talk to people about Lake Michigan. What a great idea. And then after I had that idea, I was like, well, of course, then I need to write like Lake Erie and Lake Huron and Lake Superior. And so I started this process for 3 years where I wrote a piece for each of the different lakes. And we've now recorded the album. We recorded it in December, and it comes out in August. We have pre-release copies today over at the table. And this piece I'm going to play for you is where it all started. This is Lake Michigan.
So a little epilogue. I want to read this, read the quote from that we picked from the Artist Way, which is actually where we kind of got the title for this. And this is Julia Cameron, and this book, The Artist Way, is a method that she developed to help anyone access their creativity. So Andrew and I do this. Exercises in this book, and there's a couple of different fundamental things you do every day, and but it's designed for anyone, not necessarily professionals. So Julia Cameron writes that, remember, in order to recover as an artist, you must be willing to be a bad artist. Give yourself permission to be a beginner. When I make this point in teaching, I am met by instant defensive hostility. But do you know how old I will be by the time I learn to play the piano, act, paint, write a decent play? And she says, yes, the same age you will be if you don't. So let's start. And I think the thing that holds all of us back is our fear of failure, our fear of making mistakes, the cringe factor. We don't want to be seen as a failure. We don't want others to see or experience our mistakes. So I want to end by a quote from a trumpet player and Curtis Institute graduate named Stanford Thompson, lives in Philadelphia, and he founded a program for underserved kids, after-school program called Play on Philly. He's a violinist. A trumpeter, but it's based on El Sistema, which was a string program in Venezuela that Gustavo Dudamel famously was part of. And this is a piece called Failure in the 21st Century. The word failure comes from the mid-17th century and originally meant non-occurrence or cessation of supply. Over time, however, failure has morphed into meaning lack of success or an unsuccessful person, enterprise, or thing. Under this modern definition, we rightfully try to avoid failure, even questioning ourselves when we begin to think outside the lines. Swerving to avoid potholes on the paved road, we inevitably hit them, and it hurts, because we can easily attribute our errors to a deficiency we feel we have inside of ourselves. But the true definition of failure goes back to its roots. Failure is when you stop supplying the ideas to complete the journey. Your journey will look different than mine, but each path leads to the same destination, success.